Hello to all my fellow 101 History Podcast listeners out there. It is certainly good to be back on the air with you guys, and happy Friday to you all, no matter where you live in the world. For those of us who live in the United States, hard to believe that next Thursday marks Thanksgiving. Now, I will say that while, you know, yes, Thanksgiving is an important holiday in terms of what to be thankful for, we should be reminded, and I know I've probably said this from other podcast book topic series discussions from times past, so do forgive me for mentioning it again, but it is something that shouldn't be forgotten. Sometimes we have this tendency to think that, well, when we celebrate Thanksgiving, it's only in November. Well, in the early days of colonial America's history, many people celebrated Thanksgiving throughout different times of the year, regardless of the season. If there was a bad drought and the drought had finally come to an end to where rain itself occurred to where rivers were no longer low, or I should say severely low, to where they reached back to their normal levels. People had had Thanksgiving feasts for that. They also celebrated Thanksgiving when their harvests were good, in terms of their corn harvests, their any other kind of commodity that would have been essential for survival in terms of sustaining an income for the family. Then yes, families would have celebrated bountiful harvests via Thanksgiving. So this notion that, well, Thanksgiving was only celebrated in the month of November all this time, not necessarily. We just have to be reminded that throughout history that some holidays have been celebrated on a more frequent basis, but it's not always revolved around the month in which the holiday itself takes place. We should be reminded of the fact, I want to say it was in 1863, it was not long after the Battle of Gettysburg. I want to say it was in November of 1863. That's when Congress went about officially declaring Thanksgiving as a federal holiday. So it hasn't. It's only been 160 years, folks, but it is something that we should not forget. You know, next Wednesday, the 22nd, will also mark the 60th anniversary of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy, and I have been watching a fair amount of documentaries lately on television, and no matter how many times. No matter how often a documentary or new findings about the Kennedy assassination come up, there's always something new to learn. I don't think it's one of those things that most people would never get tired of learning about if they are very intrigued by, I don't know if intrigued is the right word, but if they are very interested in why President Kennedy tragically lost his life, and what we will learn not only within, say, 10 years from now, but what we'll know in the year most notably of 2067. And I'm sure some of you are thinking, why did you just mention the year 2067, Kirk? Well, I know for a fact that according to what my dad told me, that a few years after President Kennedy was assassinated, Jacqueline Kennedy was interviewed by William Manchester, who was a well-known author. And the interview that William Manchester conducted with Mrs. Kennedy shared with him in the interview whom she was convinced killed her husband. Because right after he was fatally shot, the first words that came out of her mouth were, "They've killed him, they've killed him, they've killed my husband, and I'm holding his brains in my hand." I'm not trying to gross you all out. I really am not. But those are the words that did come out of her mouth. as soon as he was fatally hit. The interview that she did with William Manchester, she specifically stated that she did not want the interview itself or the book to be released until the year 2067. By then, her children would have been deceased. Of course, sadly, John F. Kennedy Jr. has been deceased now for almost 25 years. I still remember that very well when that happened. I still believe that had he not flown that night, or if he had just had someone else fly the plane, that he probably might still be living today. But Jackie Kennedy wanted the book to be released in 2067 for a whole host of reasons, not only to ensure that her children's well-being was protected, but I also know that back in 68, when Bobby Kennedy was assassinated, she not only feared for her own life, but that for her children, and was convinced that she and her children would be the next to be taken out. And ultimately, she moved to overseas, where her sister was living, and her sister had arranged her with Aristotle Onassis. That's how she would ultimately become Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis. So I'll be 88 years old, folks, in 2067 if I'm still alive. I don't know what the world's going to look like in 2067, but what I do know is that when the year 2067 comes out, when the year 2067 arrives and this book of Jacqueline Kennedy's comes out in terms of the interview, what are we going to learn that we could have some possible indication of now, but yet it's not going to appear for another 44 years? That's a $1 million question right there. What I do know is that President Kennedy's legacy must be one that should never be forgotten, even after 60 years. My dad and I talked about it the other night, and my dad agreed with me. Yes, it was his 9/11, and a lot of innocence was lost. You know, President Kennedy fought left and right to prevent Vietnam from escalating to where thousands of American troops would have had to have made sacrifices that, in President Kennedy's eyes, the sacrifices weren't worth making. I do believe, and I do agree with my dad, that had President Kennedy not been assassinated, American involvement in Vietnam would have been very minimal, to say the least. But that's our opinions. Others are entitled to their own opinions. But what we do know is that 60 years ago, November 22nd of 1963, the world did change. I mean, the world has always changed whenever terrible events happen. But when President Kennedy was assassinated, America really was just not the same for various reasons. As a matter of fact, it wasn't until the time when Ronald Reagan became president that America was reborn, and the United States military got a much needed boost of morale. For any of you out there, if any of you all were to ask me, if you lived under a president that bore resemblance to John F. Kennedy, who would it be? I would tell you right now it would be Ronald Reagan. I know it sounds like a very strange comparison, but the two of them came on the stage at a time when it was needed, and they both were very instrumental in many of ways. If you gave me a brief example, I could just tell you how President Kennedy laid the groundwork for going about trying to end the Cold War without firing a shot, with a success in the Cuban Missile Crisis. By the time Ronald Reagan becomes president, the Soviet Empire is truly become the axis of evil. And there were those from within the Soviet Empire who actually admitted that by the time the empire had collapsed, that Ronald Reagan was the one who knew that it would collapse all along. I still remember seeing Ronald Reagan on television saying at the Brandenburg Gate back in June of 87, "Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall." One has to wonder if John F. Kennedy had not died and he had been alive to have seen that, he would have been in awe He would have been in awe knowing that the Berlin Wall did eventually come down, and that there was no longer an East and a West Germany, but now there was a unified Germany. So we have to wonder, yes, President Kennedy laid the groundwork for how to go about winning the Cold War without firing a shot. Ronald Reagan finished it. Well, I think it's fair to say we better get back to where to what we've been doing for quite some time, and that is talking about Michael Schumacher's Torn in Two, the sinking of the Daniel J. Morrell and one man's survival on the open sea. In this podcast segment, it's going to be we're at the epilogue now, folks, but it's going to be this segment episode is going to be the first of a two-part series of the epilogue to this book. So in this episode, we're going to learn about a board that was established in the early part of 1967. We're also going to learn about improvements based upon recommendations that the Coast Guard Board of Inquiry made. We're also going to learn more about the Morrell's sister ship, the Edward Y. Townsend, as to whether or not what the future holds for her. We're also going to learn about lawsuits and whether or not a settlement was reached. So we have a lot of ground to cover, but then again, we always do, and we always come away learning something new that we didn't know before, and we always come away knowing that whatever we learned from the previous session, it only enhances what we've now just learned. So let's get the show on the road. What did the United States Department of Transportation establish come April 1st of 1967? So what do you all think? What did the United States Department of Transportation establish come April 1st, 1967? How about the NTSB, or what's better known as the National Transportation Safety Board? Of course, when I think of the National Transportation Safety Board, more often than not, I usually think of them as being involved with airplane crashes, with commercial airline jets, most notably. But we do have to keep in mind that even the National Transportation Safety Board can be involved with other related matters, such as boating incidents, where it involves the loss of life. So the National Transportation Safety Board was established as a means of determining, or I should say ruling, the exact causes of shipping accidents, and the same for aviation accidents, especially in regards to what took place involving the SS Daniel J. Morrell. Now, I'm sure many of you are beginning to wonder, okay, well, didn't the Coast Guard Board of Inquiry do its own investigation? It did. And here's the odd piece of it. The Coast Guard Board of Inquiry finished its work on the SS Daniel J. Morrell case come March 21st of 1967, less than 2 weeks before the National Transportation Safety Board was established. So, therefore, the NTSB did not choose to conduct its own investigation for conflicting, or I should say personal reasons. But the NTSB folks did provide some recommendations to the Coast Guard. How so? These recommendations pertained to strengthening the ship's hulls, which had been designed prior to 1948, like that of the SS Daniel J. Morrell, including her sister ship, the SS Edward Y. Townsend. One suggestion revolved around strengthening the deck, including the shear strakes. What are shear strakes? Strakes is S-T-R-A-K-E-S. Shear strakes, folks, are the ridges running parallel to the keel, lengthwise along the underside, as a means of improving stability by reducing the number of instances, or I should say frequencies, per a ship's pitching upward and downward, to limiting the overall operation of vessels, or I should say older aged vessels, to specific days only, which meant keeping them at dock when severe weather and brutal waves were known to be absolutely imminent. Well, you know, I think it's not a bad idea for the National Transportation Safety Board to say that, okay, older age vessels should only have a limited amount of time on the water. Well, if they only have a limited amount of time on the water, then the shipping companies could come back and say, well, if you're going to regulate how much time these guys can be on the water, then you're pretty much ruining our means of yielding successful profits. You know, yes, we can have all these new fleet of ships out on the water, but if we can't use these guys whom are still in their prime, that yes, they could still have maybe another 3 to 5 years in them. If you're not going to let us be able to use these guys out on the waters, then we're pretty much wasting our own money now. So it's a double-edged sword here. Now, in the wake of the SS Morrell sinking, how many vessels, or I should say Great Lakes freighters, got tested regarding structural well-being? I'll give you a number range. It's between 15 and 20. The answer is 16. So think about this, folks. In the wake of the Morrell sinking, 16 Great Lakes freighters got tested for structural well-being. Wouldn't it be fair to say that those 16 vessels were probably vessels whose age was that of over 30 years old? Yes. Is it fair to say that maybe a handful of those 16 vessels, maybe half or just over, were within, say, 40 years of age or just over the 40-year age threshold? Perhaps. I don't know the definitive answer, but it is possible that half of them or just over half could have exceeded that 40-year-old threshold. Interesting enough, out of the 16 vessels that got tested regarding structural well-being, only two out of the 16 ships were viewed as needing immediate action. So that's only 1/8, folks, about 8%. One of those ships got fully repaired, while the other ship was removed from service until all repairs got made. I don't know if that ship ever returned back or not. Now, yes, it is good to see that 16 vessels, for example, did get tested for structural well-being, but there still are some hurdles, or I should say obstacles. What do you think could have been the most major hurdle, or I should say the most serious of hurdles or obstacles? How about time? You know, it's easy to think, well, we have all this time in the world to get Project A, B, and C done. We might get Project A done, and we think that, oh, well, we can get Project B and C done later on in the week. That's not always the case. Sometimes projects, you know, take a little bit longer. Assignments. So time itself has become a major hurdle / obstacle. This is due to the fact that decisions behind revamping existing protocols or procedures, we're not talking days here, folks. How about months, including years? So, yes, the Coast Guard Board of Inquiry could say tomorrow, well, here are propositions A, B, and C for how we need to go about revamping existing protocols. But it could be a year or two, folks, before those changes get put into place. Okay, so here we've laid out some great proposals, but who's not to say that another shipwreck or two could be imminent in the foreseeable future? So you think you have all this time to make the changes before something else happens, but time is not always on our side, and time does not always prevent the worst-case scenarios from happening. Hang tight for just a moment. Coast Guard Admiral Willard Smith noted, per his findings, that the average age for Great Lakes freighters in 1966-1967 stood around 45 years. 45 years, folks, that's a long time. So if the average age is that of 45 years old, we're looking at vessels built, say, at the beginning of the roaring 1920s or just before the 1920s. The majority of the boats on the Great Lakes waters comprised of boats that were between the 50 to 60 year age range. So if you have vessels that are between 50 and 60 years old, you just got to wonder, okay, how many more of them are going to be out on the water still, say, 3 years from now? Even if we can get some of them, even if some of them are no longer functional, can they be turned to scrap to be used for other constructive purposes rather than just sit at the dock and rot? What new policy did the Coast Guard enact come March 1st of 1969? Of course, when I think of the year 1969, I think of Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, and Michael Collins, Apollo 11, going to the moon, and everyone, you know, watching that on national television. One small step for mankind, and then something like one giant step. But yeah, that's usually what I think of when I think of 1969 with the Apollo 11 mission. But as for a new policy that the Coast Guard enacted come March of 1969, here it is. For starters, the new policy centered upon merchant vessel reporting. But in the event a boat, or I should say a vessel, was more than 4 hours late in reporting to company stations, a communication search was to take place. Secondly, should contact not get made with the missing vessel, planes and boats were to get sent right away in search for the missing ship. Remember, folks, Bethlehem Steel officials did not notify the Coast Guard until 1.5 days later after the Morrell initially went missing. Think of how much time got lost. And we still have to wonder to this day if the Coast Guard had been notified a lot sooner that maybe, just maybe, 5 or 6 other people's lives might have been saved aboard the Daniel J. Morrell. I mean, I would have liked to have thought maybe 10, but 1.5 days of not notifying the Coast Guard, think of how much time the Coast Guard lost. And also think of now of a trust factor. But the sad part is it takes situations like this to do something different so that it doesn't happen again. Did the SS Daniel J. Morrell's sister ship, the SS Edward Y. Townsend, spend a great deal of time tied up at the dock since getting her inspection certificate revoked on December 2nd of 1966? The answer is a definitive yes. The SS Edward Y. Townsend spent 2 years docked up at the Algoma Central Railway dock in Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan. And Sault Ste. Marie being in the easternmost portion of Michigan's Upper Peninsula, Marquette being in the central part, and then you've got Houghton to the furthest western part of the Upper Peninsula. So yes, SS Edward Y. Townsend, folks, has spent 2 years docked up at the Algoma Central Railway dock. So you have to wonder, for the SS Edward Y. Townsend, is her fate coming to an end? In other words, we have to wonder, if she's been docked up for 2 years now, what's the point in even sending her back out onto the waters? Well, SS Edward Y. Townsend's owners spent a great deal of time weighing in the pros and cons of putting the vessel back out onto the waters. Come 1968, the SS Edward Y. Townsend, she was 62 years old. Remember, she and her sister ship, the late SS Daniel J. Morrell, were both built in August of 1906. To have lived to have been 62 years old is remarkable, but she is past her prime. She's not what she used to be anymore. Newer vessels, folks, are making their presence known on the Great Lakes waters by the late 1960s. If there are three that come to my mind, one most notably, who is just, 10, 11 years old, but she made her debut on the Great Lakes waters in 1958. How about the SS Edmund Fitzgerald? Hard to believe a week ago marked the 48th anniversary of the Fitzgerald sinking. And hard to believe that since November 10th of 1975, there have been no other Great Lakes shipwrecks, which has been a blessing. But that also doesn't mean that we can sit back and rest on laurels and assume that, well, with all the sophisticated technology there is, we would never have to worry about another sinking. Well, no matter how sophisticated your technology is, there's one rule that we have to go by, and that we can't underestimate Mother Nature's fury. We can't underestimate her power, because no matter how sophisticated our technology is, she'll always throw curveballs where we will be caught off guard. And who's to say that all of us who might be present in a situation where Mother Nature's fury does unleash, who's not to say that some of us will live? Some might survive, but a couple of us might not. So, yes, in 1968, you have the Edmund Fitzgerald, who's 729 feet long. She is referred to as the Titanic of the Great Lakes. You also have the Arthur B. Homer to the Edward L. Ryerson. 700-foot freighters, folks. These three that I just mentioned prevailed through hauling cargo tonnage at faster speeds, whereas older ships like the SS Edward Y. Townsend could not compete against. The Edward Y. Townsend and the Daniel J. Morrell were probably about 690 feet, but for the three vessels I mentioned who are around 700 feet or bigger, these vessels are now they're the flagships of the Great Lakes, we'll put it that way. Well, Bethlehem Steel officials agreed that the SS Edward Y. Townsend was no longer doable to be navigating Great Lakes waters, and they all agreed that she had more value in becoming scrap metal versus getting put back into service. A salvage company in Spain, believe it or not, folks, a salvage company in Spain sought the SS Edward Y. Townsend and was willing to break down the vessel for means of shipbuilding reuse purposes. Hey, I think that's smart. Don't let anything go to waste. You just don't want to let the ship sit there and rot. Let's break her down, and we can put her back into service, but we can use all that scrap metal for so many other purposes. September 13th of 1968, the SS Edward Y. Townsend began her last voyage, which started on Lake Superior, then on to Lake Huron, then downward to Erie and Ontario, where she entered the St. Lawrence River by then going to the Atlantic Ocean. Remember, folks, the St. Lawrence River connects with the Great Lakes. I mean, at one time, the St. Lawrence River, in terms of navigation, it may have connected only to Lake Ontario, but now we would have to go back to 1959 when the St. Lawrence Seaway was officially constructed to where freighters coming from the Atlantic Ocean made their way into the Great Lakes, where commerce basically went to a whole nother level that had never been seen before. And of course, if there was one city that felt its impact on a much more unpleasant scale, it was Buffalo, New York. Prior to the St. Lawrence Seaway system being built, ships came in and out of Buffalo left and right. Once the St. Lawrence Seaway system was done, it took a long time for Buffalo to make a full recovery from the loss. Now, as you know, the SS Edward Y. Townsend is not going on her own. isn't it fair to say that another vessel has to be assigned to the Townsend? Yes. And when I think of another vessel assisting her, how about a tugboat or tug vessel? This one known as the Hudson, a Dutch tug vessel. She was assigned to the SS Edward Y. Townsend. And then there was a Canadian freighter vessel known as the Dolomite. So all three of these ships or vessels sailed along the Atlantic Ocean. So September 13th, yes, the SS Edward Y. Townsend had her last hurrah. But let's forward now to 3 weeks and 3 days later, October 7th, 1968. What took place on October 7th, 1968? All three vessels, the Townsend, the Hudson, and the Dolomite, encountered a ferocious storm. Roughly 400 miles southeast of St. John's, Newfoundland, which resulted in the SS Edward Y. Townsend's breaking free from the Hudson. Gosh, I would have thought that even with, you know, it's easy to think, okay, well, if a tugboat's got the boat behind her secure, that nothing could happen. Well, here again, folks, Mother Nature, in the midst of her wrath, not only being ferocious, but never-ending ruthless. And now all of a sudden, the storm is so ferocious to where SS Edward Y. Townsend has now broken free from the Hudson. The Townsend is getting tossed around within this terrible storm. And she's not just getting rolled over gently, folks. She's getting thrown all around to where there just seems like there's no end in sight. Well, it got so bad, folks, this tossing and turning around to where she ultimately broke apart. Yeah, just like that, folks, she broke apart. And she ultimately, folks, sank to the bottom of the North, to the bottom of the North Atlantic Ocean's depths. Sadly, the SS Edward Y. Townsend met a similar, identical fate like that of her sister ship, the SS Daniel J. Morrell. I also think you all would be worth it would be worth mentioning that when the SS Edward Y. Townsend sank, I was surprised to learn of this, but when the SS Edward Y. Townsend sank, she sank, you know, yes, she sank in the depths of the North Atlantic Ocean, but she sank not too terribly far, folks. Believe it or not, she sank, she didn't sink not too terribly far from where RMS, or I should say Royal Mail Steamer Titanic sank. You know, the Titanic sank in the depths of the North Atlantic Ocean, not too terribly far from St. John's, Newfoundland. As a matter of fact, Titanic, those whom, there's a fair number of people whom perished on board RMS Titanic, whom are buried there is a cemetery in Newfoundland where a handful, either there or in Nova Scotia, where a handful of Titanic passengers are buried, and they basically their name, they never were able to determine their names, but they know that a handful of them, you know, lost their lives on board RMS Titanic, and are buried either in Nova Scotia or in St. John's, Newfoundland. So how ironic to think that SS Edward Y. Townsend, I want to say she sank at least 200 miles from where Titanic rests, but not too terribly far. Was money a driving factor, given just how vulnerable SS Daniel J. Morrell's whole condition had become. What do you all think? We're going to now get into the lawsuit aspect of this, folks. So the answer to that question is a definitive yes. Lawsuits began getting filed left and right in the weeks following the Morrell's sinking until come January 24th, 1967, when a Cleveland, Ohio judge put a halt to all suits until the liability piece element involving the Morrell's owners was officially resolved. So I can see how, yes, families want justice, they want accountability, but even the judge has to weigh in factors and say, okay, should these suits continue to go forward, or do we need to put a temporary halt on them until all outstanding matters pertaining to the other party can get resolved? In other words, we don't need to wait a whole year. We just need to give them some time. Prior to January 24th of 1967, 28 families of deceased Morrell crewmen, including the sole survivor, Dennis Hale, had all filed lawsuits. Get this, folks. They had all filed lawsuits totaling around $10 million. That's a lot of money, folks, $10 million. Whereas Bethlehem Steel was aimed at placing what's called cap limit. What kind of cap limit do you think Bethlehem Steel might have wanted per all claims? Well, I can tell you this much. It was not in the millions. So in other words, they weren't looking at, say, $2.5 or $5 million cap claim. They were looking under half a million. Okay, quarter of a million being $250,000. But if you're wanting to cap it under half a million, for Bethlehem Steel officials, they wanted to place a limit cap on all claims that would not exceed $400,000. You know, from time to time, you do hear in the news where some states, especially in the United States, I had learned this some time back with regards to healthcare matters, where some states had passed money limits as to how much one could, as you know, for one, you know, if a healthcare agency was sued for whatever reasons it met the criteria for being sued, some states enacted laws where there were money caps that a plaintiff could be entitled up to, and in some instances it was like $5 million. Some opponents have said, well, there should not be a limit. But of course, that's a debate that would has no end in sight, for better or for worse. So yes, believe it or not, folks, all of the families of the deceased Morrell crewmen, including the sole survivor Dennis Hale, had filed lawsuits that that totaled around $10 million. Now, there were other suits filed, most notably in Buffalo, New York. I do know that there were. Some of the Morrell crewmen hailed from Western New York. I can tell you right here that if I can find the page here, I'll let you know here. Yes, there. I know, like, for example, Norman M. Bragg, who was a watchman, he hailed from Niagara Falls. We also have Valmore Marchilladone from Kenmore outside of Buffalo, who was the first assistant engineer. We also have Charles Sestakoskis, who was the porter from Buffalo. So, and then Henry Rischmiller, who was a wheelsman from Williamsville outside of Buffalo. So, and then there was Chester Kanishka, who was a fireman from Hamburg, south of Buffalo. So, yes, in case you were wondering why other suits were filed in Buffalo, well, Buffalo, you know, being on Lake Erie, ships are coming in and out of Buffalo, but There are families living in Buffalo who lost loved ones that were aboard the SS Daniel J. Morrell. So, yes, other suits were filed in Buffalo. Cecilia Ann Stoechek, whom was the widow of Art Stoechek, and Art Stoechek, as you know, was one of the four men on that life raft with Dennis Hale, the other two being John Cleary and Charles Fassbender. Cecilia Ann Stoechek had requested $500,000 for the loss of her husband's earnings, including an extra sum of $250,000 for pain and hardship he endured on the life raft. You know, I can only imagine what is going on with these families. You know, for Cecilia Ann Stoechek, for example, she found out about the Morrell sinking listening to the radio. I mean, you have to remember the Bethlehem Steel officials did not notify the families, which was a huge no-no. Not to get childish by saying no-no, but that is just, to me, that's just flat-out wrong. But yes, for Cecilia Stoechek, you know, she's got a family to think about. She's got her parents and four children. So it's not about, okay, yes, I am requesting $500,000, but it's not about I, me, myself here. But I'm thinking about money that can be used not only to help me and my family out, but also to help compensate for not just for short-term purposes, but long-term purposes. So these hardships, folks, are not hardships that might go away within a couple of years from now. These are hardships that could last long-term. As for Dennis Hale, on December 8th, he went to court and requested $150,000, but he soon changed his mind to where his suit was to $500,000. And it wasn't because he wanted to change it, because he wanted more money, but he changed the suit to $500,000 by disputing that the SS Daniel J. Morrell was no longer seaworthy, along with operators failing to repair the aged vessel, including placing proper emergency equipment. And for Dennis Hale, the sinking of the Morrell led to Dennis Hale suffering long-term pain and permanent disablement, to where eventually he could just no longer work on Great Lakes waters. So, yes, we can say, well, I'm suing for $500,000, but there has to be other reasons for why you're wanting to attain this money. For one, Dennis Hale knew, of course, we can't pin the blame on him, but he was smart enough to at least tell the Coast Guard Board of Inquiry that, hey, look, this ship was no longer seaworthy. I saw where rivets were just no longer properly functioning. If one set of rivets aren't properly functioning right, then who's to say that the remaining sets of rivets aren't going to give out, if not on this voyage, but perhaps on another voyage? So the bottom line is that the operators did not properly repair this vessel to where, yes, eventually it would have been retired, but if they had made further modifications in terms of repairs, this vessel, being the late SS Daniel J. Morrell, might have gotten, in my estimation, maybe another 3 to 5 years. Even so, there's still not a guarantee, but, you know, it's one thing to say that, yes, we're concerned about safety, but you have to be good at it. And I think for a lot of us, sometimes that might be easier said than done. Yes, it's important to, make profits and, you know, establish good business earnings. But if you're not keeping track of safety and thoroughly inspecting your ship, then you are asking for some serious consequences down the road that could not just prove bad, but maybe beyond bad, to where you could have a great loss of life. And look what we've now come upon. It's bad enough that people did lose their lives on the SS Daniel J. Morrell, but 28 out of 29 men. That, to me, is just beyond unspeakable. Did Bethlehem Steel decide to settle with all surviving heirs of deceased SS Morrell crewmen? They sure did, and they were smart. After 4 years of court litigations, Bethlehem Steel agreed, and listen to this, folks, it may not be the grandest sum, but I'll explain to you a little bit more here shortly. Bethlehem Steel agreed to pay out $2.75 million, $2.75 million to families of deceased sailors. This took place on December 9th of 1970, in which the settlement was reached. It was the largest settlement in maritime history. Now, of course, you are paying now $2.75 million to families of deceased sailors. You have to wonder, how is each family who lost a loved one, being an uncle, husband? Yeah, I mean, think about it. Are all families going to get adequate or equal sums of money? Well, it turns out that the settlement money was based upon the settlement money was all based upon the size of a crew person's family. So let's say, I'm just going to use a fictitious last name, the Joneses. Let's say Thomas Jones lost his life on the Morrell. There was no Thomas Jones, but I'm just using a fictitious name here. Let's say Thomas Jones had left behind his wife and five children. So given that Thomas Jones has five kids, which is a lot of kids, that means Mrs. Jones and the children are going to receive more money. John Smith lost his life, but he left behind a wife and, say, one or two children. They'll receive money, but not as much as the Joneses. But the bottom line is all the families will receive money. It's just that if a family has more children per family, then the more money the family will receive. Did the SS Daniel J. Morrell's bow section get discovered prior to or around the time when Bethlehem Steel reached the settlement verdict? No. The SS Morrell's bow section did not get discovered until May of 1979, 13 years after the vessel itself had sunk. Let's learn about a guy named David Trotter. I'm sure many of you all have never heard of his name. I didn't even know about this guy until I read the book. But David Trotter is a Great Lakes shipwreck hunter and dive explorer. He's known for having located wrecks on all Great Lakes waters with the exception of Ontario. He's very involved in having explored most of Lake Huron's waters. In 1977, 11 years after the Morrell sank, David Trotter was the second person on Lake Huron to own what is called an LRN-C, being a long-range navigation system whose purpose was designed for determining just how close a shipwreck location stood per where the device itself got launched in tracking down the objective, or I should say the physical objective, an actual shipwreck. So this is pretty revolutionary for its time, folks, in the 1970s. I mean, this might be the early precursor to what we would eventually know as ROVs, remote operated vehicles. Diving to the Morrell wreck site in 1979 is very treacherous. How so? At that time, divers were still using regular air versus mixed gases in diving to deep level wrecks. There is what's called diver's narcosis. Diver's narcosis limited the overall time one could spend at the bottom. Diver's narcosis, folks, can have all kinds of impacts. Like it could impact your mood, motor functions to judgment. Then there's what's called the martini law. Yes, I know, martinis, alcoholic beverages, folks, but martini law is also related to the narcosis piece of it. The martini law measured the effects of narcosis per all depths of of not just a dive, but of the of dives that explorers performed. Narcosis is not an issue involving dives under 66 feet. So, in other words, you've got to get to that 66-foot threshold to avoid feeling the ramifications of narcosis. But per each descent of 33 feet past 66 feet, the threshold will have its effects. Basically, one essential effect is that if you descended 33 feet past the 66-foot threshold, it would be the equivalent of consuming one martini. So you're going to feel some 101 side effects. So for Mr. David Trotter, he's got obviously got some challenges ahead of him. For David Trotter, though, his team sailed to the estimated area where the Morrell sank, and through the use of side-scan sonar, they spotted a large object in 200 feet of water. The Morrell's stern section is what had been discovered in 200 feet of water. His team located the stern section early in the day to where they still had enough time on their side to look into some other exploration and see if they could come upon anything else. It just so happened, folks, that less than an hour later, another target was detected, but the long-range navigation system, could not pinpoint the exact location right away. So this LRNC, while it may not pinpoint exactly where something is, it can give you a ballpark radius of where you might be in position to it. In other words, it can give you the best estimate there is, but it's not going to give you that complete grand slam spot, if that's the best way for me to describe it to you all. So, given that David Trotter's team could not pinpoint the exact location right away, they decided to try again later. And so 3 weeks later, Trotter and his team set out on finding the object. And they spotted the object per Larry Copeland's diving expertise. John Dulzo, whom was the expedition team partner, went about on his dive by swimming alongside what they confirmed was a sunken vessel. They saw something in white. Okay, this is interesting, folks. They see something in white. Well, it just so happened, folks, that what they saw in white happened to be the pilot house to this boat. We might be getting warmer, folks. We might, you know, we're obviously seeing a boat that shipwrecked. But are we beginning to wonder if, in fact, that the boat we're seeing could be something that has been on so many people's minds for some time? Yes. So what turned out, we obviously now know that what turned out to be in white was the boat's pilot house, where identification matched as being that of the SS Daniel J. Morrell. Folks, they found the SS Daniel J. Morrell's bow section. They had, years earlier, they had discovered the stern. What did David Trotter and his associates discover per photographs taken of the Morrell's bow section? For one, the bow, like the stern, had entered to rest in an upright stance. In other words, sitting or standing atop straight, not crooked or bent. Secondly, the Cambria logo was positioned along the mast nearest, or I should say nearby, the Morrell's bow section, And third, the Morrell's anchors, folks, remained intact. They had never come off. Even at the moment of impact hitting the ground at full force, those anchors still remained intact. To me, that's beyond impressive on one hand, but it's also beyond unfathomable to think that with such sheer force hitting the depths of the floor, that you would think everything underneath would have just come apart. And the only reason I say that is because I learned not long ago that when, given that, yes, RMS Titanic, of course, given that she split in two, people sometimes think that, well, when she split in two, there was only two sections of her wreck. Over the years, historians and diving experts have confirmed that the wreck of the Titanic is in five different sections or zones along the utmost furthest depths of the North Atlantic Ocean. David Trotter's photography could not reveal, his photography was amazing, and given what they were able to reveal and determine, but if there was one thing that the photography that they partook in could not reveal, was the mass size of the Morrell's wreck. But they did discover that a clock inside the pilot house was frozen with a time of 1:55 a.m., just shy of 5 minutes to 2 a.m., At 1:55 a.m., folks, that's when the SS Daniel J. Morrell's bow itself had officially sunk. The stern held on above Lake Huron's surface for 1.5 hours. The men along the stern side knew their chances of survival were minimal, and their chances of survival centered on spotting a freighter nearby. There was no way of ever knowing how many men attempted to enter onto the stern's life raft. The wreckage of the bow, folks, served as a silent witness to such an unthinkable loss of life. 28 out of 29 crewmen are dead. And you have one man whom is left to wonder, why did I get spared? Why did I get spared when I tried so hard to save Charles Fassbender, John Cleary, including Art Stoechek on that life raft? Heck, if there had been other men on board, I would have done the same for them. I would have done the same for anybody. Why am I being spared? I should have died with all of them. If you're Dennis Hale, you probably do have to feel that way, but at the same time, you do have to take some form of comfort knowing that you're alive, but also knowing that it's just not right, knowing that so many other people lost their lives. Well, we've covered a lot of ground in this first of our two-part series to the epilogue to Michael Schumacher's Torn in Two, the sinking of the Daniel J. Morrell and one man's survival on the open sea. When I'm on the air again next for the final podcast segment episode to the series, we're going to learn about Dennis Hale's life after the settlement. And it's going to be one that I can tell you this much has had ups and downs, and how Dennis Hale managed to go forward with life even after 10, 15 years after the incident happened. I think it's fair to say that you go on with life as best as you can. Some things don't go away 100%, but you go on as best as you can and try to live your life to the fullest. And also in this final segment episode, we will learn a little bit more about Mr. Daniel J. Morrell that I do feel is worth sharing with you all. Thank you for your time as always, and no matter where you live in the world, continue to stay safe. Take care.